Well, tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about the lost empire of Atlantis. Stand by, Gavin Menzies joins us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you love ancient history, you're going to love tonight as we talk about the lost empire of Atlantis. Gavin Menzies is the New York Times bestselling author of 1421, the year China discovered America, and 1434, the year China ignited the Renaissance. He served in the Royal Navy between 1953 and 1970. His knowledge of seafaring and navigation sparked his interest in epic voyages of a Chinese admiral, which he described in his works 1421 and 1434, and he's done it again with The Lost Empire of Atlantis. Here's Gavin on Coast to Coast. Gavin, how are you?
Oh, well, I'm fine, George. Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's great to be back on your show.
Two Gavins in my life now, you and my grandson, who's going to be 4 years old at the end of this month.
Oh, well, that's splendid. Give him my best regards.
Very different name. And I spent 9 years in the United States Navy, Gavin. So you and I touch paths a little bit. You were a little earlier there than I was, but we were there nonetheless, huh?
Well, that's splendid, George. I remember we discussed this six years ago, and you kind of invited me to your show.
You know,
it's great to talk to you.
I want to get into Lost Empire of Atlantis. You've done some great work here, but I want you to give us a review, if you can, of your two works, 1421 and 1434, and how you claim that China discovered America. It wasn't Christopher Columbus. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, my first book, 1421, The Year China Discovered America, came about as a complete accident. I was writing a book about European history in the Middle Ages, and I came across a map which showed islands in the Caribbean. Now, the interesting thing about the map was that it was published in Venice in 1421, that's 70 years before Christopher Columbus set sail for the Americas. And I reckon the two islands shown on the map, distinctive islands, were Guadeloupe and Puerto Rico. If I was right, that meant that there was somebody in the Caribbean before Columbus, 70 years before Columbus. I thought it must be Portuguese secret voyage, so I told the Portuguese ambassador. He introduced me to the National Archives in Lisbon, and I found there that it wasn't a secret Portuguese voyage that had produced this map 70 years before Columbus. It was a completely separate voyage by unknown people. And my book was about my quest to try and track down those people. And I found, to my astonishment, in fact, it was the Chinese who had mapped the Caribbean by 1418. And they subsequently gave those books, maps, to the Pope, and he got them to Christopher Columbus. So Christopher Columbus sailed to the Americas with a copy of a Chinese map, which had been drawn 70 years earlier. And that was my first book. It was just a complete accident that I came across this map.
What kind of a craft do you think, Gavin, they used to get here?
Who the Minoans or the Chinese?
The Chinese.
Well, the Chinese had the most enormous ships. The shipbuilding records have been found, as have the dry docks in which the ships were built. You can see the dry docks today in Nanjing, where the remains of one of these huge ships, which was 400 feet long.
Wow.
And
wow.
Nearly 80 feet wide. It was as big as a football field. And there were nearly 1,000 men on board, and they could create their own vegetables. They could desalinate water. They could stay at sea for months on end. So they were, the whole of Christopher Columbus' fleet and the whole of Magellan's fleet could have been placed in the hold of one of these giant monster ships which sailed from China to the Americas. And they produced maps. And in my book, 1434, I show a picture of the map they drew of the Americas. And it's very accurately drawn.
Did they colonize the Americas, Gavin, or did they just come for a little bit and go back?
That's exactly right. They came for a little bit and went back. Basically, the Chinese, people of enormous self-confidence, they didn't feel it necessary to create garrisons where they'd been. For example, the Portuguese, the early voyages, they thought they were going to be attacked by the local people, so they left armed camps when they went back home. But the Chinese didn't. They just came and they traded. They were there for trade and they went back home again. Now, what happened was that building this enormous fleet, there were over 2,000 ships built in the five-year period between 1415 and 1419.
Of that size, of that magnitude, 400
feet? No, not nearly. There were only a few, about two dozen of that size. But there, there were nearly 2,000 ocean-going ships in all. Now, the wood required to build these ships and at the same time rebuild the Great Wall of China and build the Forbidden City, it denuded China of wood. Virtually all available wood was used up. And the emperor, Zhu Di, required more wood, so he sent his armies down into Vietnam to get more wood from the Vietnamese forests. And this provoked an uprising in Vietnam. And there was a very famous general called Lê Lợi who attacked the Chinese forces and beat them. So China suffered in the summer of 1421 a catastrophe in Vietnam. She had her Vietnam 600 years before the Americans.
That's right. That should have been a lesson to us.
Well, and to all the Europeans, I think. America wasn't alone. And so the Mandarins said, we can't go on like this. The country's going to be bankrupted. So they basically resigned. The Chinese cabinet resigned in the summer of 1421. And the emperor was finished, basically. And so when the ships returned, they were all mothballed and the crews were paid off. And the records of these Chinese voyages to the Americas were burned, or the orders were given to burn them. And so it all came to a grinding halt. So basically, the Chinese, this fantastic fleet, built at colossal cost, they didn't really achieve much apart from accurate maps of the world, which the Europeans could use.
Would you say that at that point, the 1400s, that they may have had the world's best naval fleet?
Definitely. They had far and away the best naval fleet. They could navigate out of sight of land. They could calculate latitude and longitude. They could stay at sea for months on end. The sailors had enough vitamin C not to get scurvy. They could desalinate their own water. The big capital ships, the fighting ships, were protected by smaller ships. And they, in the convoy, there were grain carriers, water tankers. It was just the most amazing series of voyages, really, which has never been equaled then, before, or since.
Gavin, what was their downfall? I mean, they seem to have been so advanced, inventing gunpowder. They have this huge naval fleet. They're traveling earlier than anybody. What happened to them?
Well, George, you're quite right. Basically, China, the Emperor Zhu Di, who came to power in 1402, was a very, very ambitious man. He decided to rebuild China as it was in the great Tang Empire hundreds of years earlier. So he built this enormous forbidden city on the edge of the Mongol lands. He created a huge army to track down the Mongols and defeat them. He built this giant, huge fleet, and he also rebuilt most of the Great Wall. Now, this financially devastated China, and the poor people were reduced to eating grass. And the Mandarins, when the fleets returned, they decided to seize control, to stop all overseas voyages, to burn records so that nobody could later on track down what had happened, and to destroy the blueprints for building ships so that they could never again be built. And that was more or less carried out. So China retreated into her shell, where she stayed for 600 years. It reached its peak. The xenophobia of the Chinese reached its peak in about 1440, mm-hmm. when all contact with foreigners was banned. Edicts were passed that anyone who did trade with foreigners would be executed, and that finished it off.
So basically, that's when the door was closed, right around that time period.
Exactly. The orders were given in the 1420s, and they got more and more severe, culminating in the 1450s. And that was the end of exploration, overseas exploration. China just retired to its shell until Deng Xiaoping came along.
And here they are now, coming right back again. Interesting.
Exactly.
How history repeats itself, Gavin,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. I totally agree.
Let's talk a little bit about your new work. We'll spend some time on it tonight. The Lost right. Empire of Atlantis. How did you get interested in this?
Well, George, this again was a complete accident. I had no intention of writing about Atlantis at all to start with. When I was young, the very word Atlantis was the sort of refuge of cranks and nutters. It was a sort of nobody sensible believed it. Well, in 2008, basically after my book 1421 was published, we were very, very lucky and it sold worldwide. And we set up a website and we got hundreds of thousands of emails. And a persistent criticism of my book 1421 was that I'd been too simplistic, that I said that Chinese made world maps and so on in the 1420s. Mm-hmm. And many, many readers said, that's true, but you've overlooked the much earlier Chinese voyages. In centuries before 1421, they sailed from China to the Americas and back again, hundreds and hundreds of years earlier than that.
Jeez.
So I thought I'd go and check this out. And with a group of friends, we went to Central America in 2008, and we went around all the museums in the areas where I thought the Chinese fleets had been trading hundreds of years ago. And basically, we got back just before Christmas in 2008, and I worked hard to write all this up into a book. And come Christmas 2008, my wife and I were terribly tired, and we decided we'd go to Crete, which is an island in the Mediterranean Sea, where we'd been before. Mm-hmm. We'd stay in a monastery. We'd forget all about books and emails and problems, and we'd just drink lots of wine, go to mass, and enjoy ourselves. So we did just that. Now, on one of our walks right down to the southern shore of Crete, we came across a beautiful marble palace, which was very, very large and very beautiful, and it stretched over many, many acres. It was absolutely enormous. And we bought a little booklet which described this palace, and it claimed that the palace was built, the first one on the site, in 2,500 BC. That's 4,500 years ago.
My gosh.
Well, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, you know, this must be the world's oldest building, so it must be wrong. And I managed to contact the professor who had written the pamphlet, and I said, look, what are you talking about? It can't be that old. And he said, oh, yes, it is that old, because we can show it is, because in the pharaohs of Egypt's tombs, there are paintings which show people coming from Crete, southern Crete, to Egypt, visiting the pharaohs and bringing gifts. Now, the pharaoh's tombs can be very accurately dated, and indeed, they go back to 2,500 BC and beyond.
Ah, okay.
So this was absolutely astounding, because it meant that ships 4,500 years ago could sail from southern Crete, this place we'd found at Phaistos, this palace, all the way to Egypt, visit the pharaohs, and then they could find their way back again. So not only could they sail the seas 4,500 years ago, but they also must have had a system of navigation which enabled them to return safely back to Crete.
Yeah, they had to.
They had to. And this was even more extraordinary. How on earth could ships know how to navigate in 2,500 BC? Well, what we decided to do, my wife and I, was we'd more or less end our holiday, and we'd go around the museums in Crete to find pictures of these ships, if there were any. And we went around the museums in Heraklion and various other sites, Knossos and Phaistos. And there were lots and lots of pictures of these ships on pottery, which could be dated back to 3000 BC. So it was a true story. And I was then, by then, I was absolutely hooked, because I thought the Chinese, you know, the first to discover the world. And here we have ships that sailed 3000 years before the Chinese.
Before that, yeah.
So I thought, this is an astounding story. Let's try and find a wreck of one of these ships. Well, we went around all the museums, and we couldn't find any wrecks or anything taken out of wrecks. And we asked why. What happened? You know, what went wrong after 2500 BC? And we were told that there was the most enormous volcanic eruption of a small island called Santorini, which was about 70 miles north of Crete. And this mega explosion had filled the air with volcanic ash and so on. And it had blotted out the sun, and the ash had landed on Crete and North Africa and Egypt, and it had wrecked all the crops. And this huge eruption had been followed by a massive tsunami. And the tsunami, which was 100 foot high, had just smashed up all the ports in northern Crete 3,000 years ago.
Wiped out everything, I bet.
It wiped out absolutely everything. So we thought, well, what do we do now? And we decided we'd go to this island, Santorini, to see if we could find any positive evidence that that's what happened. So we got a ferry from Crete to Santorini. Ferries in the eastern Mediterranean are very, very good. So we got a ferry, we went to Santorini, and we found that the old capital of Santorini, the city 4,000 years old, which is in the south of the island, had indeed been excavated by a group of Greek archaeologists. Now, the interesting thing is that these archaeologists managed to drill down into the old city, and they hit a bullseye. They went straight down into the center of the city, bored their way through 15 meters of volcanic muck, and they ended up in the house of a seafarer, a very wealthy seafarer. Now, how do we know he was a seafarer? Because around the walls of his palace, there were beautiful frescoes, painted pictures of ships, of a fleet returning from somewhere to this island of Santorini.
So about 45 feet underground, under volcanic ash,
was
this house. And I'm sure there were other houses all over the place.
Absolutely. There's a city there. Yeah, absolutely right. Well, now, this picture showed ships, and you can date it, of course, because it must have been before 1450 BC when this volcanic eruption happened. So the pictures of this fleet returning were at least 3,500 years old, and they were very advanced ships. You could see the paintings showed all the rigging and the sails, the method of controlling the sails, the type of hull, the number of crew on board. So you could say for sure these are ocean-going ships.
Would you call it high technology or pretty good technology?
Well, very, very good technology, in that the sails could be adjusted with 11 different ropes. You could have full sail, square rigged to sail before the wind. You could tilt the sails to sail into the wind. You could lower the sails in the event of a squall, and so on and so forth. So you could say for sure these ships were ocean-going, and they were 3,000 years before Columbus, and they were three times the size of Columbus' ships. So this was a really astounding revelation to me. I thought I knew about ships. I'd been in the Navy and so on. So we tried to find wrecks of these ships, and once again we had the most amazing stroke of luck in that there were three wrecks in the eastern Mediterranean, about 200 miles east of Crete on the Turkish coast.
All right, hold on right there, Gavin. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the lost empire of Atlantis. Wait till you hear some of the things we're going to get into. With our special guest tonight, Gavin Menzies, as we talk about his work, The Lost Empire of Atlantis, and we'll get right into that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's talk about these three wrecks you were talking about, Gavin, then we'll get into some more of these mysteries. Go ahead.
Right. Thanks, George.
Sure.
Now, we were told that there were three wrecks of ships over 3,000 years old. One dated 1600 BC, one dated 1300 BC, and one dated 1100 BC. And they'd been found off the coast of Turkey, 200 miles east of Crete. Crete, if you remember, was where the paintings of these ships were. So we decided to go to the coast of Turkey where these ships had been found. And they've been raised from the bottom over a series of dives over a 10-year period. And the wrecks, two of the wrecks, have been placed in the museum in a place called Bodrum. Well, the fascinating thing is that these ships were carrying copper, ingots of copper, and the copper reacted with the seawater to prevent weevils and worms of various sorts drilling into the hull. So when the ship sank, large chunks of hull were left intact on the sea bottom, and this is what's been raised up. And because the hull was largely intact over quite a bit of the side of the ship, it meant that the sea currents couldn't get into the hold, and they couldn't wash the cargo away. So the cargo in these ships was very much as it was when the ship sank around 1450 BC. Well, the fascinating thing was that in the hold, the cargo came from all sorts of different places. It came, in fact, from six different civilizations. So you had elephant tusks from India. There was hippopotamus teeth from Africa. Mm. There was blue glass from Egypt, gold from Syria, amber from the Baltic, and copper from we didn't know where. I'll come to that in a moment.
Okay.
We thought it would be sensible to go to the places where this cargo had originated from, and see if there was evidence that Minoan ships had, in fact, visited those places years ago. We started off in the Baltic. Now, nobody questions that the amber found in the holds of these ships on the Mediterranean seabed came from the Baltic. And that's a round trip of 3,000-plus miles from the eastern Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar, across the Bay of Biscay, up through the North Sea to the Baltic. So, was there any evidence that Minoans had been in the Baltic around 1500 BC? And we found that there was evidence. It had been found by a director of the Max Planck Institute, a man called Hans-Peter Duer. And he'd found in peaked at a level of roughly 1400 BC, he'd found some enormous storage jars which had been dated to 1400 BC. And because of their decorations and the type of construction and all the rest of it, of these vast storage jars, he could say for sure they couldn't have been carried by camel or horse. They must have been carried by ship, and they must have come from Crete. So there we had direct evidence.
How far, Gavin, was the Greek island of Santorini from Crete?
It's 70 miles to the north.
70 miles, okay. So yeah. Relatively close. So I guess when this volcano went thousands of years ago, Crete got hit pretty bad too, right?
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. Now, some Greek archaeologists have done a study of the size of the tsunami which hit northern Crete, and it was over 100 feet high. And they found that because there are seashells from the seabed which have been impaled on cliffs over 100 foot high in northern Crete. And nobody disputes that anymore. It's the world's the biggest tsunami there's ever been. And I think it also wrecked the eastern Mediterranean. It sent a surge of water up the Nile. It wrecked the Nile Delta. It caused the most terrible plague in Egypt. And the pharaoh, Akhenaten, he had to change course dramatically. So it was an absolute catastrophe, this tsunami.
Now, Santorini, anyway, are you saying, though, Santorini was Atlantis?
Yes. The Atlantis, I didn't realize until my book was actually finished that I'd stumbled by complete accident on the fact that that what I'd been describing, the Minoan Empire, was exactly what Plato was describing in the Empire of Atlantis.
Ah.
So I didn't set out in any way to find Atlantis, and I didn't set out originally to find out about the Minoan Empire, but I found in the course of my travels over a year and a half that the Minoan Empire stretched from North America, which I'll perhaps explain in a moment, okay. right across the Atlantic to northwest Scotland, the Orkneys and Faroes, to southwest England, Stonehenge, to northwest France, southwest Spain, and across the Mediterranean through Egypt to southern India.
They were everywhere. And were the Minoans what are now the modern-day Greeks?
Yes, they were the forerunners of classical Greece.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
As it happens, the Greeks inherited a massive amount of intellectual, artistic, mechanical, all sorts of inventions and discoveries which the Minoans had made. Now, if I could just explain how this came about. Basically, my book is a description of visiting all the places from whence the goods and hulls of these ships came. So we went to India. We found direct evidence of trade between India and America in 1500 BC. That's 3,500 years ago. We found evidence of trade between Egypt and America and between Stonehenge and Egypt and Stonehenge in England and India and so on. So that's what the book shows. Now, I had a tremendous stroke of luck because when I finished the book, I sold it to Orion, who are the world's largest publisher now, and they issued a press release in April 2010. That's just over a year ago. And the Greek government picked up this press release, and they asked me if I'd be interviewed by Greek television. And of course, I said I'd be delighted. Now, unknown to me at the time, there was a Greek professor also on the program who didn't speak English, who I'd never heard of, didn't know anything about. And he was a mathematician. And he phoned me after the show and emailed me and said that he'd spent 20 years deciphering the Minoan language, Linear A, which is a sort of holy grail for linguists. Would I like to meet him? So I said, yes, you bet I would. So I went to Crete and met him, and he sat home. And essentially, he said to me, I can prove that the Minoans sailed to Greenland, across the Atlantic, to northwest Scotland, to southwest France, southwest Spain, to across the Mediterranean to India. And so in other words, he could show that everywhere where I said they'd gone in my book, he could show that the Minoans had traveled by translation of this Linear A language. Well, this to me was, and to him, was absolutely astounding because neither of us knew the other. I hadn't got a clue about his work. I'd hardly mentioned language in my book, and he never heard of me. So meeting Professor Tsikritsis really achieved two enormously important things. First was that his translation must be correct because it was corroborated by my book, all the evidence that I'd found. And so it couldn't be a coincidence if he'd found that the Minoans went to, say, southwest Spain, and which is where I said they go, and that was it. You could say, well, that's a coincidence. But you can't say it's a coincidence when he's found they went to southern India, Egypt, the eastern Mediterranean, western Mediterranean, and all the way to America.
How advanced were they, Gavin? I mean, did they have incredible technology? Yeah.
They were absolutely amazing. I mean, he's found out their mathematics, for example. They had arithmetic and linear progression. They had all sorts of different algebra. They could work out the value of pi, which, as you know, is the ratio between circumference and the radius of a circle. And they got the value of pi right to five figures, 3.14159.
Unheard of.
Which is more advanced than the Mesopotamians or the Egyptians. Similarly, phi, the golden ratio, they got the correct ratio to 1.618, which the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians had not achieved. So in mathematics, they were more advanced than anyone else in the world at that time. They had a language, Linear A, as I've been explaining, they had throughout their empire, trading empire, they had common units of measurement, common writing system. They had common weights and measures. So traders, for example, in Syria, who were buying a load of copper, used the same weights as they used, as were used in the Great Lakes when the copper was being extracted and brought to Eastern Mediterranean from the Great Lakes. They had the same copper weights to determine a common system of measurement.
So these people were everywhere.
They were absolutely amazing sailors. Now, the book, my book, has 36 chapters, and 31 deal with their sailing expertise across the world. And there's 3 chapters on the Great Lakes, which doubtless we'll talk about shortly.
Now, let's get back into Atlantis then, because the sinking or whatever happened to it fascinates me. Of course, throughout the ages, as you know, Gavin, people have theorized that Atlantis was a continent, that something happened. They didn't know exactly what, maybe an asteroid hit, whatever. So your contention is based on your research was that there was a Greek island called Santorini, which was Atlantis. Was it called Atlantis then?
No, you think? it was called Thera.
Okay. And that Plato was making reference to that.
Yes.
And then this huge volcano just inundated it. The tsunami wiped it out. When you were on that island of Santorini, Atlantis, did you see any remnants of the tsunami from, you know, the thousands of years ago?
Well, the tsunami originated in Santorini. So I know is the answer, because the tsunami went from Santorini across the Mediterranean and smashed up northern Crete.
Okay, it was the ash from the volcano that did them in.
Exactly,
okay.
Exactly, absolutely. Okay. Well, now, Plato, if I can just take a moment on Plato. He, first of all, he emphasizes time and time again that his description in Critias and Timaeus, which are the two descriptions of Atlantis, he emphasizes time and again that it's a true story. It's not a fable. It's not a moral work.
That's right.
It's actually true. Now, what he's describing, first of all, he describes the island people, and he describes people living on different islands. He doesn't describe them living on one island. And the two islands, as I'll explain in a moment why, are Crete and Santorini. Now, what he says was that the people who lived on those islands were literate. That means they had a written language.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were very, very skilled metallurgists. They imported copper, and they used it for all sorts of purposes, and they became very, very rich. Now, that part of his description fits just exactly what there is in Crete and Santorini. He goes further, and he describes the two islands. One is round, 12 miles across, which is what Santorini was before the eruption, and one is not quite square. It's oval-shaped, 400 miles long, and it's got mountains in the middle. And the bigger island was the seat of the kings of Atlantis, and the island produced all sorts of fruits and vegetables and perfumes. Now, what Plato has described so far fits Santorini and Crete and nowhere else. There was no other island at all at that time which had written language. The only places that had written language were Crete with its Linear A and Linear B and Santorini. And they were the only islands that were where the metallurgy was far advanced. There was metallurgy in other words, making copper and bronze artifacts in Egypt and Mesopotamia, but they weren't islands. So on that side of it, I suddenly realized at the end of my book that Plato was describing exactly what I'd found about the Minoan Empire. Now, Plato goes on to say that in one day and one night, the Atlantic civilization was destroyed.
Gone, wiped out.
It was destroyed because the people got too greedy. Now, that's exactly what happened. The Minoans And Plato describes them coming across the Atlantic through the Straits of Gibraltar, which were called the Pillars of Hercules, and then attacking Greece. Well, that also describes exactly what the Minoans were doing, bringing copper from the Great Lakes across the Atlantic into the Mediterranean, and they intended to attack Greece.
Now, how did they get destroyed, though, by their own greed?
Well, they were destroyed because the gods...
Ah, the gods did it to them. Okay.
The gods did it. They sent a huge wave, which smashed up all their ships and covered their harbors in volcanic muck. And also the sky turned black and so on. So Plato's describing exactly what happened.
Did this happen so fast they could not escape?
No, it didn't. The interesting thing is that they knew it was coming. How do we know? Because the town which has been excavated in southern Santorini, it's a place called Akwetiri, the houses are just as they were when the people fled. So, for example, storage jars, huge storage jars of salted fish and vegetables preserved.
Still there.
It's still there. And they're underneath lintels of the doors. So you can see the people knew a catastrophe was happening. So they moved the stuff where hopefully it wouldn't get smashed to bits in the eruption.
Did they find people? In the
no,
ash?
They didn't. No, not at all. There were no graves at all. No dead
that's,
people.
That's
no,
strange.
No personal. It's absolutely
you know,
no...
In Pompeii, of course, you know, they found a lot of bodies.
Exactly. It's quite the opposite of Pompeii. As you so rightly say, there people are just found as they died on that fateful day in AD,
that's
whatever
right.
It was, 78. But for this eruption in... Santorini, they knew it was coming, and they took all their valuables and fled. And I reckon they all got on board the ships, and they went to Crete, where, of course, basically their cities were wiped out by the tsunami.
That's right. You know, think of bad luck. They go from one area to the next that gets hit with a 100-foot tsunami, for crying out loud.
Absolutely, yeah.
My gosh. Well... Stick around, Gavin. We're going to come back. We're at the top of the hour. We're talking with Gavin Manise, his book, The Lost Empire of Atlantis, his website, of course, gavinmanise.com. And let me spell it for you. It's gavinmanzies.net, not .com, .net. And that is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. When we come back, we'll get into more of the story of Atlantis. We'll take some of your phone calls a little bit later on tonight as well. I shall be right back on Coast to Coast AM.